I want to thank you guys for being here this morning. And open up your Bibles to Genesis 35. We're going to be in verses 1 through 15 this morning. Genesis 35, verses 1 through 15. I want to ask you a question. Oh, Josh is looking at me. I'm having a pastor guy moment. I forgot to dismiss the kids. That's awesome. For those of you that have no idea who I am, I'm Jonathan. Pastor guy has a big scar on the side of his neck where a ferret attacked him. And that's not me. Thanks, Josh. It's like he works for Southwest Airlines and he's got like the thing he's guiding the plane in. So, all right. Genesis 35. So here's my question I want to ask you. What do you want said about you at your funeral? I know that that's somewhat a sobering, yet perhaps even a life-shaping question. If today you could write your obituary that's going to be printed in some newspaper somewhere, if you could write the words out for a eulogy, which literally means good words, what do you want said about you on the day that your friends and family celebrate your life? What do you want said about you? If you've ever been to a memorial service, maybe you've been handed a program, and on that program, there is a picture of the person, and there is a date of birth, and there's a date of death, and there's a dash in between. And that dash is the life that you lived. So what happens at a memorial service, we celebrate whatever happened in that dash. People get up and they say these words about you, and what do you want them to say? This sounds ironic, but I love attending the memorial service of a believer because people get up and they talk about how this transforming reality of Jesus and the cross and the resurrection changed that person's life. It's not that everything's all a bowl of cherries. It's life goes up and down. But we talk about, we say good words, we eulogize people, and they have lived life after Christ. It has transformed their life, and it has changed the relationship state that they are involved with. It's an amazing thing to listen to the words that are shared about somebody who has chased hard after Christ for a lifetime, regardless if they're young or they're old, when the Lord takes them home. So what do you want said about you? You know, why all this talk about funerals and memorial services and eulogies? You're like, man, this is a downer subject. Well, the deal is in our passage this morning in Genesis 35, we're getting to the end of Jacob's life. We have been walked through the stories of Abraham, we've walked through the stories of Isaac, and we're getting to the end of the Genesis stories about Jacob. We're in Genesis 35, Jacob does not die until Genesis 15, so it's still a couple of years, but we're entering into the twilight of his life. And what we're going to find out is what are the things that we can learn from the way this guy lived. And if he would have asked that question, what do I want said about me at my funeral? And then he would have lived life backwards. What would his life have been like? Have you ever heard that? They say, what do you want said about you at your funeral? And then you live your life backwards to actualize that and make that a reality. If you were here last week on Father's Day, Pastor Guy shared from Genesis 32 in, you know, the God Wrestling Federation SmackDown with Jesus and Jacob, and they're wrestling, and the greatest battle that we face in our hearts is that battle, that struggle, that wrestling match to surrender our lives fully to Jesus. So what I want to do this morning is I want to piggyback on that struggle, and I want us to wrestle with, what do you do after you've surrendered? How do you fully live in that place of surrender? How do you live in that place of what Eugene Peterson calls a long obedience in the same direction? Now, the questions and how you answer that and how you're going to fully live in that, it's going to determine what we say about you at your funeral. Here's the question I want you to wrestle with this morning. The big question, even bigger. How do you fully live? How do you fully engage? How do you fully commit in this transforming reality of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Because once again, how you choose to answer that question, how you choose to engage in that question, it's going to determine what we say about you when your time on this rock is done. How do you fully live in the transforming reality of Jesus Christ and his gospel, his good news, his salvation for your life? How do you live in that? I think the twilight stories of Jacob's life are going to help us with that. So Genesis 35, read with me. We're going to start in verse 1. In verse 1, Genesis chapter 35, then God said to Jacob, he said, arise, go up to Bethel and live there. Make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods which are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments and let us arise and go up to Bethel. And I will make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods which they had and the rings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was near Shechem. You know, the first thing that we see as we near the end of Jacob's life is we see God continually calling him back to recommit his life to God, his transformation that he wants to do in his life, and then God's mission in this world. So Jacob is sitting there. He has made a spiritual vow. He's made a commitment. He said, I want to live in this covenant relationship with God. And all the way back in Genesis chapter 28, Jacob is on the run from Esau. Remember, Jacob is the guy who runs a lot. His name means cheat, usurper, heel grabber. He's kind of the villain in some sense. And he seems like his life, he's constantly on the run. And so he's on the run from Esau, his older brother, who he's cheated out of the birthright. Esau wants his life. So he's running. He ends up at this place. He falls asleep. God, in chapter 28, appears to him in a dream. Remember Jacob's dream? There's a ladder. There's angels going up and down. It's the heaven, the gateway to God and the gateway to heaven. And God shows up. And in this dream, he reiterates the Abrahamic covenant. He says, Jacob, I have chosen you. I have called you, I have blessed you so that you will be a blessing. So that you will be a blessing to the world around you and your descendants will be a blessing. I'm going to put you in this land. I'm going to be your God and I want you to walk with me. He's given that same message to his grandfather, Abraham. He's given the same message to Jacob's father, Isaac. And now he gives it to him. So back in Genesis chapter 28, Jacob realizes in some sense the divine moment that has just happened, that God has shown up to him in this extraordinary way. And Jacob says this in chapter 28, verse 16. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and he said, surely this the Lord, Yahweh, the covenant name of God, the Lord is in this place and I did not know it. He was afraid and he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God and this is the gate of heaven. So realizing that divine moment, he says, something amazing is going on here. So he enters into this vow with God, this spiritual commitment that he makes with God. Down in verse 20, then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear and that I will return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. So he names the place Beth-El, which literally means in the Hebrew, house of God. So he makes this commitment that this is going to be a place of worship. This is going to be a place that he continually returns to tithe and to give his life and to give offerings to God. So Jacob's life goes on. It's going on. He's hanging out. He's living with Laban. He's accumulating wives and kids are coming out, all this kind of stuff. And God patiently in Genesis 31 says, hey, remember you made that commitment? Jacob's the tyranny of the urgent life, midlife crisis, all this kind of stuff. He's getting cars and boats and all that kind of stuff. And he keeps cruising and trucking through life. And finally God goes, Jacob, you've wrestled with me. I've wrestled with you. You're walking with a limp. Remember that night? I called you to be this man after my own heart. Arise and go to Bethel. Go to this place that you made this spiritual commitment and meet with me there and worship with me. So Jacob, he tells his family, he goes, guys, pack the camels up, pack the tents up, everything you need. But then here's the irony of what he says. He says, put away the foreign gods. And I'm like, what's going on in this dude's house? I mean, this is the guy, this is the family that God has chosen to change the world for him. And they're still playing the pagan game. And if you go back into Genesis chapter 31, when Jacob is running from his uncle Laban, one of his wives, Rachel, when they're about to head out of town, she steals the family gods Imagine like the little guys that pose for trophies, you know? You know, the little golf guy, she breaks him off the tip of the trophy, she puts it in her bag, and they get going. And the pagan culture, the ancient Near Eastern culture, was very superstitious, and they're like, if we have this little rock that looks somewhat like a god, then whatever that god is, he'll bless us. And somehow, Jacob hasn't led his family. Somehow he hasn't stepped in and say, last time I checked, we worship the creator god and not the little guy who poses for trophies. So get rid of those things. You're going to worship. You're going to reconnect. We are committing ourselves as a family back to God. And there's always this propensity to be chased and to chase after foreign gods. There's always something, not only in the culture around us, that's the easy part, but it's our own hearts that want to chase after foreign gods. We're going to talk more about that later in the sermon, so you're not getting off on the foreign gods thing and where does that impact you. But we continue on in the story and what we see in Jacob's life. So they pack their bags, verse 5 in chapter 35. So as they journeyed, there was a great terror upon the cities which were around them. And they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. In the Hebrew, it more indicates that God causes this great terror to fall upon the cities. Because Jacob is kind of, in his tribe, his clan, they're seen as kind of this fighting family. There's kind of a story back in Genesis 34 that you can read, and everybody in the surrounding areas pretty hacked off at Jacob and his family. But God protects them as they're journeying to Bethel. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there, and he called the place El Bethel. So it's already called the house of God, but then all of a sudden he says, God of the house of God. He says, we're going to worship there. He builds this altar. And because God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. Now, Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, remember, Rebekah is Jacob's mother. So kind of the beloved grandmother, she dies along the way. So there's grief. And they bury her below Bethel under the oak, and it was named Elon Bakuth, which means the oak of weeping. So God says, look, Jacob, you have this spiritual commitment that you've made and to live in this covenant relationship with me. And you're going to face hardships. There's going to be this terror around. I'm going to protect you through that, but you've got to make this commitment. And they show up and they worship. I love watching the lives of people who recommit their lives to chasing after Christ. See, I'm that person. I'm the prodigal son. When I flip to that chapter in Luke, that's my story. I grew up in this great, amazing Christian home. And, you know, it was like the Cleavers with Jesus, and it was awesome. But what happened about my junior year of high school, I checked out. You know, I wanted to be a rock and roll star, so I started hanging out and playing with guys in garage bands. And if adults aren't there, you can imagine what a bunch of high schoolers do in garages, you know, besides play music. And so I just walked away from the Lord for years. After 7 years, I found myself in a jail cell in San Marcos, Texas, having been arrested for a DUI and was inebriated. And God gave me a chance to sober up in more ways than one. And so I remember that night just vividly in this jail cell, and there's a guy with teardrops tattooed down his face. There's another huge guy who's pulled a loaded firearm on a cop, and he's throwing up on himself now because he's drunk and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? And I kind of wake up, and I literally, it was the day that the Lord changed my life. I came to Christ as a kid, but he said to me in that jail cell, he said, choose this day who you're going to serve. Choose today who you're going to serve. Because if you keep living this lifestyle and saying you're Johnny Christian and then doing whatever you want to do, that's not what I designed for your life. And that was the day that, in a sense, I recommitted my life to Christ. And I go back to that day, kind of this high watermark in my spiritual experience, a low point in my life, but God showed up. He said, arise, go to Bethel, go to the house of God, worship. Some of you have come back to Christ. Some of you are doing this thing in your life. And there's this rejuvenation that happens when you come and you say, man, I've tasted the goodness of God. I've chased after the foreign gods. But God is calling me to arise and to come back. And I see it on your faces. I see it in your heart. I hear it in your story. The rejuvenation that happens when you come into a loving, worshiping community that's centered on Christ. And you worship and you get reconnected with Jesus. And you get reconnected with his followers. It's beautiful. And that's what Jacob is being called to by the Creator God. Now we go on in the story and we get what's called more specificity in that call that Jacob has. He says this in verse 9. God says, look, I'm not only calling you to recommit, but I'm calling you most importantly to experience this new reality, this divine reality of blessing, of transformation, of impact. Verse 9 in chapter 35. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram and he blessed him. God said to him, your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. Thus he called him Israel. God also said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you. A king shall come forth, and kings shall come forth from you. The land which I gave to Abraham and to Isaac, I will give it to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. The very first thing that when Jacob, he recommits his life, God shows up and he says, Jacob, I want to bless you. I want to give you my good word. And here's what my good word is. Your name is Jacob. Your name is heel grabber. Your name is the usurper. Your name is the cheat. Your name is the wretched villain who continually controls everything and runs away from me. But you know what? I can use a guy like you. And what I will do is I will put my life in your life and I will transform you and I will change your name to Israel. If you remember, if you were here last week, Pastor Guy talked about that name Israel. It comes from two Hebrew roots. The first one is Sarah, which means to struggle, to persist, to fight. And then El, which is the name for God. So we have to ask the question when we're figuring out what does Israel mean? Who struggles? Is it that we are struggling and persisting and wrestling and fighting with God? Or is it that God struggles, he persists, he wrestles, he fights on our behalf? And here I'll make everybody happy. I think it's both. It's a both and. It's what we call a double entendre for the fancy word. It's a double meaning. There's this truth to it that God says, here's the gospel. Here's the reality. I fight for you. I battle for you. I wrestle for you. I struggle on your behalf. But you're going to chase after the foreign gods in your own heart, and you're going to struggle with me. You're going to wrestle with me to relinquish control and realize that I wrestle for you and that I will fight your battles for you. Israel lived a lifetime of that. These foreign gods are always calling them back to chase after something other than God. And God says, but I will transform you. I will transform you. But listen to me. He doesn't transform Jacob. He doesn't change his name from the cheat to God is going to fight for you so that Jacob can sit there and watch World Cup soccer 24 hours a day. He doesn't say that. He says, Jacob, I'm going to change you so that you take over the world for Jesus. You remember all the way back to Genesis 12, the Abrahamic covenant? God says, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bless those that bless you. I'm going to curse those that curse you so that... What does he say? So that you will be a blessing. It's not for us. If you read your bulletin, when you come in, the very first thing it says is building a community of Christ for the world. We do not exist merely for ourselves. We exist to take over the world for Jesus. And God reminds Jacob of that reality. He says, I want you to live in that. I want you to experience that. I want you to lead your family. I want you to lead your home. And I want you to be transformed and I want you to have impact. As we've been studying Jacob, so many people have nudged me when Guy is talking about the name of Jacob because we have a son named Jacob. And they're like, hey, did you know that that's what Jacob's name meant when you named him that? And part of me wants to play dumb and go, man, we went to Borders. We got one of those cool baby name books. You know, we were thinking about Jesus, Milky Way, Sunshine from the 60s or like Dakota or Scout or something cool like that. And we just came to Jacob and Jacob Dylan, Bob Dylan's son from the Wallflowers. I want him to be a rock and roll star and support me in my old age. So no, we didn't know. And dang, we should have thought more about that. Negative. That's not the way. After 5 semesters of biblical Hebrew that were painful and thousands of dollars later, I better know what the name Jacob means. And we knew that. When Paige and I were thinking about names for this little boy, we knew he was going to be a boy because Jacob isn't a good girl's name. And so Paige and I knew the stories of Genesis. And we knew that Jacob in Genesis was a cheat. He was a wretched villain. He was a control freak. He was a manipulator. But we also knew that God said, I can use a guy like that. And so our prayer for our Jacob's life is, he's a wonderful boy, but he's still disobedient. Paige would say he's just like his father. And so is broken world, a broken kid living in a broken world. Our prayer is that God would say, your name is no longer Jacob, but your name is this kid that I'm going to use. And if you'll let me, you'll come to Jesus. You'll embrace the cross, the resurrection. I'll put my spirit in you. I'll give you stuff like love and joy and peace and gentleness and patience and goodness and kindness and faithfulness and self-control. And I will use you to change the world and to take over the world for Jesus. That's why we named our kid Jacob. Every one of us are Jacobs, even if that's not what it says on your birth certificate. God can use a person like you. I don't care how messed up you think you are. This dude was messed up, and God changed him and changed the world through him. Amazing picture. So Jacob, in some sense, recognizes that. He recognizes this call. And in verse 13, when God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him, Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. And he poured out a drink offering on it. He also poured oil on it. So Jacob named the place where God had spoken with him Bethel. It's like a reiteration. Jacob goes, okay, in chapter 28, I had that divine moment. God is in this place. This is an awesome place. I made this vow. So it's like Jacob gets these rocks again, these stones, and he picks them up and he struggles and he pours out a drink offering and oil in the place. And he goes, this is the house of God. This is a divine place, and God has a calling on my life. Now, you have to remember that these stories, the stories in Genesis, were given to who? They were given to Israel. They're written somewhere between, conservative estimates, 1446 and 1400 BC, 2,000 years ago. But they're written for Israel, if you remember, who has literally been going through hell. 400 years of intense, oppressive slavery. God, in all of his power, in all of his majesty, and in all of his wrath, he frees them. They go through the Red Sea. Israel, these people, they're standing. Jacob's descendants, they're watching. God crushed the most powerful army in the known world. They see this divine hand of the Lord, this divine intervention, this divine miracle. And now they're standing in the doorway to a new beginning, a new reality as the people of God. But God knew that once, not even only in their own hearts, but in the culture that they're going to go into, the foreign gods are going to be calling them. The foreign gods are going to be calling their names, asking them, wooing them, tempting them to leave this God that has rescued them. That's their story. That's our story. Here's my heart for you. I was praying for you guys this morning, 6 a.m., sitting in my little office, which is great because my office used to be the nursery over there, and my new office is much cooler. Thank you. I'm praying that you'd know Jesus. And here's what I would call my pastoral prayer for you this morning. This is what I was praying for each of you this morning. That you would fully live in this transforming reality of the gospel of Jesus Christ. My prayer, my heart, my burden, the reason that I swing my leg over the bed and I do this every day as a pastor is I go, my heart is that my life, Paige's life, Jacob's life, your life, that we would chase hard after Jesus. That we would fully live. We would be fully engaged. This wouldn't be a spectator sport. That we wouldn't play church. That we'd be fully engaged. That our lives would be saturated with this transforming reality of the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. And what I want to do is I want to unpack that for you. If it's my prayer, I've got to explain why I'm praying that for you and for my own life and for my family's life. And I want to unpack that in reverse. I want to start with the gospel. If you don't know the gospel, if you don't know the transforming reality of this good news that God has broken into this messed up, broken world in Jesus, you will not choose it and you will not fully live in it. The gospel is this. The gospel is that God has interrupted the brokenness in a sense of this world. He has come into this world through Jesus Christ. And he finds messed up, broken, wretched villains that we all are. Did you hear me? That we all are. And he says, you are a sinner. but you are saved by grace because of the cross, the blood, the death of Jesus Christ, and I raised him from the dead and I gave him a new life. And in the same way, I will give you a new life if you will embrace the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. And I will put my spirit inside of you. And I will transform your life. And I will overflow your life with love and with joy and with peace and all of that fruit so that you will change the world for Jesus. Not so you will sit and have hell insurance in a holy huddle for the rest of your life. That's not what God saved you for. That's not what Jesus went to the cross for, just to save you, simply just for your eternal destiny. Yes, that's a part of it, but he says, I'm calling you to change the world for Jesus. That's what Jesus once said about you at your funeral. This person embraced Jesus, the cross, the resurrection. They were transformed by the Spirit, and they changed the world. They were on this holy mission to change the world for Jesus. That's the gospel. If you don't believe it, you don't understand it, you will not live in it. Here's where we come to the foreign gods, though. You can cognitively, you can intellectually understand the gospel. You can do the north-south head nod and go, I get you. Rock on, Pastor Jonathan. That's great. Preach it, brother. And then you can just do whatever you want. If you don't fully live in it, fully commit your life, here's where the foreign gods come back to haunt us. The foreign gods that continually beckon our allegiance and call us to chase after what some theologians call lovers less wild. That song that we sang, Come Now Fount, man, that's my song. I actually asked John to sing it because that's my song. Because there's this one line in it that's my story. It says, prone to wander. Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. If you're anything like me, my heart is a civil war every day between the Spirit and God's heart for me and my heart for me. And I'm prone to wander and I'm prone to leave the God I love. I'm prone to chase after the foreign gods. All of us are. None of us are immune from this stuff. I don't care what your foreign gods are. I don't care if it's, for some of you, it's a relationship. For some of you, you're chasing so hard after this relationship, and that's where all of your meaning and all of your purpose and all of your destiny is tied up, and God's sitting there going, man, just chase on. You'll get to the end of that thing, and then you'll come back and you'll run back to me. For some of you, it's addictions. Okay? And I'm not just talking porn and alcohol and drugs. I'm talking about some of you men, you're addicted to your job. You go to your job and you find all of your meaning. You're finding all of your worth from how many hours and how many zeros come after the first number in your paycheck. You're chasing after that stuff. It's the foreign god and it's like, it's not that bad. 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 hours a week. Oh, your kids, your wife will raise them. And they're like, Dad, who the heck is Dad? Oh, he's the guy that's chasing after the corporate ladder. That's a foreign god. Women, listen to me, especially moms. Listen to me. You can punch me afterwards, okay? I see so many moms in their life, especially when kind of the empty nest, the last kid flies the coop. Moms, God has given you a holy calling to raise your children and to love them and to nurture them. But I see so many moms, all of their meaning, all of their life is invested in their kids. There's a beauty about that, about giving yourself sacrificially to your kids. But all of a sudden, when I see a kid stumble, I see the mom start pulling their hair out, and they're like, they're meaning, and they feel horrible about themselves, and they're like, I'm a wretched parent, and I'm horrible. And I'm like, because you're chasing after something other than Jesus. Raise your kids in Jesus. Love them, nurture them, but give them to Jesus and seek your life and your meaning in him. What is your foreign god? What's the thing that woos you away from chasing after Jesus day after day? Because every one of you has one of those things. There's something in your heart that woos you away. And God says, arise and put away those foreign gods and chase hard after me at the house of God in this relationship with me. But here's where I want to go. Before we celebrate communion, here's where I want to go. I want to tell you what I think is the most insidious of the foreign gods that honestly is in many of our hearts and is especially being peddled to us by a postmodern culture. Okay? It's this. We have neutered Jesus. We have emasculated him. We have turned him into this little granola-eating guru that drinks lattes and wears tights. We've turned him into, this as one author puts it, this motivational life coach who's going to help you lose weight, make money, all with his pithy acronyms and his cheerleader enthusiasm. That's what we've done to Jesus. You remember in the Chronicles of Narnia? You remember who Aslan is? Aslan is the lion of Judah. That's C.S. Lewis's, this is the picture of Jesus. And you remember Lucy, the first time she's getting ready to meet him? And she's pretty nervous about this. And I think she's talking to Mr. Beaver in the story. And she says, is he safe? And Mr. Beaver goes, goodness gracious, no, he's not safe. But he's good. See, we want a safe Jesus. We want to turn like the Lion of Judah into this little playful kitten that we throw a little yarn ball to. That's what we've done to Jesus. We don't believe that Jesus is this risen, victorious Lord of Lords who defeated death. Now, hear me out here. I want to have a balanced view of Jesus, but we've swung the pendulum over, and part of it is the feminization of our culture. We've swung the pendulum over, and now Jesus is our girlfriend. And we've swung it over, and now I know when Jesus came, his first advent, the first time he came, I know that he came meek and mild. I know that he came in a manger, a borrowed manger, in some little backwater town in Israel. I know all of that. I know that in his first advent in his ministry, that he's sitting there and he's going to the marginalized and the oppressed. I know in Luke chapter 4 that he stands up and he rolls out this scroll and he says, I'm here to save the oppressed. I'm here to free the brokenhearted and the captives. I know all of that. But if you stay there, you will never think that Jesus is the risen, victorious Lord and that he fights for you. You never will. And the problem is in our culture is peddling us Dan Brown's from the Da Vinci Code's version of Jesus. Our culture is saying, Jesus was just this ordinary guy. He had the hots for Mary Magdalene. They got married. They sired a secret line that's now whisked away into some secret mountains in France. And now what your whole role in life is to be a kind person, to hug trees, and to chase after the divine feminine. That's not the Jesus of the Bible. The way the scriptures present Jesus now, he is the risen, resurrected Lord who defeated and battled Satan in hell, and God raised him from the dead, and he walked out, bulked up with muscles, just walked out into that new daylight, and he says, I will do battle for you. I am God. I'm the victorious Lord of all creation. That's the gospel. The gospel does not stop right here. The gospel says, I am the creator God. And when he comes back, what does he come back as? He comes back as, what one author says, this tattooed King of Kings riding a big white Harley down, and he's got a sword, a fire launched from his mouth. Listen to me. If you don't see that side of Jesus, if you don't see that side, you'll never think that Jesus fights for you. You'll never live in the fullness of the gospel. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. Who wants a Jesus that's just a motivational life coach? Who just wants a Jesus that's going to help you lose weight? Who's going to want a Jesus that just gives you three steps to a happy, healthy you? I'm like, that's cool. That's cool for helping me through the next 70 years, somewhat. But that's not the Jesus that is the Lord of all creation that I'm going to say, I'm going to give every ounce of my life to. Now, I know for some of you, I'm going to get some punches afterwards. I understand that. And you're going to say, yeah, but we love the Jesus who hugs us and embraces us. And I'm like, yeah, I love that guy too. But what we do is we leave out this Jesus. We forget about this Jesus. We forget about him all bowed up and said, I'm the victor. And whatever battles you're wrestling with, whatever fights you're fighting, you want to control everything, the Jacobs that you want to be. He says, I'll change your name to Israel. I'll fight for you, but you got to let me. And he will wrestle you until you walk away with a limp. I promise you that. And once we start to see Jesus as the risen Lord who fights for us, then the gospel starts to get filled out. And we say, that's a Jesus I can follow after. That's a Jesus I can commit my life to. How you see Jesus, listen to me, how you see Jesus is going to determine what is said about you at your funeral. How you answer those questions, do I believe that Jesus is this victorious Lord of Lords who's coming back again in victory and in power? Yes, meek and mild and tender and gracious. And it's the beauty of Jesus is that he can do both of those at the same time and do it right and do it well. Or am I going to continue to fight? Am I going to continue to chase after the foreign gods? Am I going to try to fight my own battles? Or am I going to go, okay, Lord, I actually believe you. I actually believe your word. I believe that you want to fight for me. And I'm going to let you. And I'm going to live fully in that. That's my heart for you. That's my prayer for you. That's my prayer for our church, that people wounded and broken would walk in and would love them with the arms and the hands of Christ and would say, man, you know how amazing Jesus Christ is. You know how amazing he is. What a great theme to take into communion. And what's going to happen here in a moment is our ushers. Our ushers are going to pass this plate and it's going to have bread. Our ushers are going to pass this plate and it's going to have cups from the fruit of the vine. And as you hold these, communion is a symbol. The bread and the cup is a symbol of a divine reality. It's a symbol that says, this is Jesus' body. This is his blood. In his divine weakness that was poured out for you. But in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus says, the next time that we eat this together, it's going to be in heaven. Next time that we eat this together with Jesus, we're going to see him. He's just going to be bulked up. It's going to be amazing. And he says, I want you to picture that every day. Every time you taste this bread, you taste this cup, I want you to realize that I died for you. I battle for you. And he's sitting at the right hand of God, battling for you as we speak. I promise you that. And I can promise you that because that's what Scripture promises you. So I want you to wrestle with that. I want you to wrestle with Jesus this morning. I want you to hold that bread. I want you to hold that cup. And I want you to say, Jesus, who do I think that you are? Do I have an inadequate view of you? You swing the pendulum too far to this side, you go wrong. You swing the pendulum too far to this side, you go wrong. Say, Jesus, through your Spirit, help me to have a balanced picture of you. Here's the battles I'm facing. Here's what I'm struggling with in my life. Here's what's going on in my heart. And I surrender. And I know more than likely I'm going to walk away with a limp. But it's going to be a reminder that I'm weak and you're strong and you'll battle for me. What do you want said about you at your funeral? I want people to say, this is a person that fully lived in the transforming reality of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let's pray. Father, my heart and my prayer is that we'd just see Jesus. That we'd see the totality of how the Scriptures and how you show us who Jesus is. That he's the Creator God who spun galaxies off the tips of his fingers. That the pre-incarnate Christ who wrestles with Jacob, the angel of the Lord, and that who shows up in the back door of the enemy's camp in a stable. And Father, that with all of your love and all of your grace and all of your desire to redeem broken people, heals people, but he invited them to this greater mission of chasing after you and your kingdom and your rule. And when we see Jesus again, he's coming back. And he sits right now at your right hand as the victorious Lord of all creation. And Father, my prayer is in my own life that I'd see Jesus that way. And I guess that I'd stop battling how I fight you. It seems like at times every step of the way. And I guess that I'd just surrender to you and let you fight for me. And I pray that. Father, I know that I have brothers and sisters out here this morning that are just battling and they're struggling and they're fighting. And it seems like the enemy's out there, but oftentimes it's in their own hearts and you're wrestling with them for them to see Jesus fully. So, Father, as we celebrate communion, as we hold this bread and we hold this cup of the fruit of the vine, help us to see Jesus. Help us to come to you and give you those battles. We love you, Lord. Thanks for showing up the way you do. We pray all of this in Christ's name. Amen.